Everyone asks me about the hands, but they were not what struck me when I first met Ferus Manus. It was the eyes. To look into them is to look into a mirror too dark and vast to reflect anything but that which it wishes. There is beauty in that, after a fashion. The Remembrances of Arcaduana, Volume 267, The Fall of the Lords of Gardenal. Chapter 2. With a little over 40 years out of Lunar Dry Dock, the Fist of Iron was young and headstrong. If she could appear at times intemperate, then Adept Xanthus, Mechanicum representative to the 52nd Expedition Fleet, was swift to point out that such bellicosity was only to be expected in a fiery spirit still unsure of her strength. Beams of nanoposited plasteel groaned under the weight of titanic real space engines. Life support systems of the most advanced and adaptive design to have emerged from the laboria of Terra since the Dark Age of Technology cycled the atmosphere with the vehemence of a fire-breathing drake. An outsider might have mistaken the carbonaceous dust on uncommonly stiff breezes as a symptom of deterioration, but that was how the Medusans liked it. And to her bones of basalt quarried from the Felgati plains, the Fist of Iron was a Medusan ship. She would be the first of many. From her bristling, fully automated gun decks to her ablative hull armour, from her interplexed auspex and auger systems to her Geller generators and every aspect of her interiors, the loosed genius of Ferus Manus had been poured into her design. As Medusa was dark, so too was Fist of Iron, lit only by the glow of consoles and of luminescent stones quarried from the seabeds of Medusa and inset into the ceiling fixtures. As Medusa was frigid and hostile, so too then was Fist of Iron. Hundreds upon hundreds of kilometres of corridors and crawlways sheathed in iron glass and stone, every wheel hatch as magnificently austere as the frozen tundra of Karashi. Better to carry the distemper of the Primarch's adoptive homeworld to the stars, and to take pride in it, than to let comfort moderate their warrior spirit. And, as with Medusa herself, the surface cold was a front for a broiling inner fire. Moses Truerak remained plugged into the Xiphon's slumbering spirit long after the deckhands had completed post-flight checks and logged off shift. The glow strips were dimmed, his eyes closed, but his mind was alive with sensation. Copper-brown clouds, the roar of engines, a glimpse of black, the wing of an aircraft as it rolled out of his crosshairs. "You need a lighter touch on the ailerons." Without opening his eyes, he brushed the flap levers with his fingers, then moved to the flight stick. "And not so belligerent with the stick. She wants to fly, brother. Let her." He bit back the urge to answer the memory, nudging the unpowered stick left, right. Even in her sleep, the Xiphon longed to be airborne. A Terran would have been hesitant about describing such experiences as dreams. The aircraft's flight cogitator had been powered down, shut off from external stimuli, allowing its combat logs to be decompiled for exload. But he was Medusan. Reverence of the machine came as naturally as turning his face from the wind. He knew that it dreamed. "But do you love her, brother?"
"I know that you talk to her when you're alone in there."
The black-hulled Primaris Lightning came into view. Its appearance spiked his bloodstream with adrenal compounds, enough to make him forget that this was not his dream. He triggered the las cannons. In the deserted hangar, nothing happened. But in the dream shared between Moses and the Xiphon, bolts of ultra-high-energy las streaked across the jinking strike fighter.
"Combat is more than numbers and angles. It is a joust."
As a mortal, he had grown up with machines. Life on Medusa depended on their protection and their favour. They demanded respect, not love, and each of the Legion's machines had their own character, their own favourites. The Xiphon chafed against its pairing as vociferously as Moses had at first. He could hardly blame it for fighting him. My brother doth protest too much. Moses shook his head. The last thing he needed was his wing brother's words looping around the Xiphon's already truculent spirit as it slept.
After the lightning, he murmured, pulling lightly on the stick. We will do it right this time. Trurak?
It took Moses a moment to register that Ortan Vertanus's voice had not arisen from the Exlo dream. He tried to focus. The lightning. It was moving off, about to thrust out.
I know you're in there. I can see your carapace lights from here. I'm practicing,
he snapped back through gritted teeth, trying to hold on to the dream.
We all know you need the practice, but enough is enough. You smother her with your affections.
Moses became aware of chuckles, but not this time from the dashboard vox.
I recognize every word you use, but put together they make no sense to me. Disconnect yourself, Trurak.
This voice belonged to Wing Commander Palulinus. The tone it used sternly discouraged further argument. Reluctantly, Moses reached behind his neck and detached the neural shunt. It came away from his skull with a crunch of metal. Immediately, the simulus glitched, then died. He took a deep breath of Fist of Iron's cold, caustic air, blinking quickly to reacquaint himself to this version of reality. He was still in the Xiphon's cockpit, but the canopy was up, and it was dark, illuminated only, as Vertanus had pointed out, by the point lights of his flight carapace. Still blinking, he leaned from his cockpit, carapace creaking, and saw the Emperor's children of Scythe Squadron were all down there. Edoran. Doer, impossible to please Edoran. His wing brother, Tyro, holding a glass and wearing a stretched grin. Palulinus's laconic wing brother, Seker, standing with crossed arms and peering into the darkened hangar with professional interest.
Did you hear?
Said Edoran, his expression characteristically heavy and joyless. Plug-in sights and new spheric tethers showed like chunky jewellery under the collar of his carapace.
The next time we fly together, it won't be a game. It's not just Kama with whom you need to develop an understanding. Men, too, have their singular natures.
The Xiphon's name meant something like stiletto or blade in Captain Arkaduana's ancestral tongue. Moses hated it.
Oh, hurry up and get down, said Tyro wearily, before he really starts. I do not understand how fraternizing will facilitate an understanding of relevance.
They're not all like that, are they? Vertanus asked.
The captain introduced me to Lord Commander Duquesne, said Palulinus. So I can say not.
The wing commander looked up at Moses.
You are about to fraternize, then you are going to enjoy it. That's an order. What do you have in mind?
Moses had come up with all manner of theories on the sorts of activities that the Emperor's children might consider diverting. None of them good.
Trust me, said Palulinus. You'll like it.
On either side of a large hemispherical dais, huge grinding pistons rose and fell in the smoke-wreathed penumbra of a Medusan night. The distant clangor of hammers and presses trembled through the sheet flooring. Steam rose from the gratings, condensing almost as soon as it hit the cold air to dew on the handrail that circumferenced the curved edge of the dais. The cavernous space was pungent with hot oils and solder and the visceral power of the machine. The Anvilarium reminded Arkaduana of the manufactories of the Urals, though even the 10th Legion's colossal flagship, for all its youthful distemper, could not rival those cathedrals of industry for scale. Flattening the damp sheaf of parchment between his hands, Arkaduana examined the charcoal sketch he had made of the scene with a critical eye. He had captured perfectly the sense of motion, the way the surfaces trembled, how the interplay of hanging vapours and the loom stones embedded in the iron glass and gilt candelabrum crafted a chiaroscuro of black and grey. But his attempts at conveying the sense of awe that he had been hoping for had not been borne out. His intent had been to evoke the memories of Manraga, or Narodnia, but the Dark Age grandeur of those Gothic forges was nowhere to be found in his work. In a moment of anger, he tossed his stick of charcoal aside, over the outer rim of the dais, and far, far to the lower Enginarium decks.
Captain!
Startled from his reflections, Arkadiana looked up. A single bridge traversed the heaving machine pits from aft. The heavy-booted step of Captain Gabriel Santar rattled the gangplates and twanged the cable stays like a score plucked along a tuneless harp as he crossed to the dais. Though he had removed his helm and gauntlet, he remained otherwise clad as he had been on Vesta. He smelled of grease and sweat and engine heat. His features still bore Vesta's chill in their crags. The immense armature of his cataphracty plate glittered with trembling droplets of condensed vapour. Arkadiana wondered if it was a deliberate show of strength.
Gabriel?
He dipped his head respectfully.
It was an honour to match swords. You did well. Your choice of drop sight was just a little obvious, and Amadeus does tend to forget that I was there in Central Africa and the Pan-Pacific.
He sighed.
The Imperium was smaller then. I was not on Rust, of course, but he never was one to vary a winning formula.
Santar shrugged off the platitude.
You're early. I enjoy the solitude. It is hard to find on your ship.
The loss of the Third Legion's gene stocks after the Battle of Proxima had decimated the Legion's strength. He had been one of the 200. With Fulgrim's aid, they had recovered, but they were still not a numerous legion. Like many of his brothers, Arkadiana had come to prefer it that way. Empty halls left room for reflection.
"What were you doing?" said Santar, leaning forward.
Arkadiana folded the flawed sketch and tucked it away in his sleeve.
"Nothing. A diversion. Is it any good?" "It depends what you want from it." "Do you think it good?"
Arkadiana frowned.
"No. I've been supervising the return of my company and equipment from Vesta. And you've been drawing? I assure you the warriors you loaned me are in capable hands. But when one finds that one has attained perfection within a certain field, there is little point in pursuing it further."
The Iron Hand bridled.
"Perfection? A bold claim."
Arkadiana shrugged. "Perhaps, but it had been 300 years since he had been reborn unto the Emperor's likeness, and he had not been beaten yet." Santar remained quiet. It fell to the machines of the Enginarium to fill the gulf between brothers.
"You did well enough, too,"
the legionary finally conceded. He looked awkward, as though ill-accustomed to hearing praise spoken aloud in this place.
"I've never seen those handled with such skill."
He referred to the two blades that rested in silk scabbards at Arkadiana's hips. Timur had a grip of woven gold, its blade slightly curved, and a shaped pommel in the form of a stallion's head with a tassel of black horsehair. Athenia was longer, its fuller deadly straight, its crossguard narrow, Greek and runes of abstract meaning glittering the length of the thinly covered blade. They were Charnabal sabres, forged to unique ritual and alchemical preparations by a master maker of old terror. To possess one was the Legion's highest honour for swordsmanship. He had two.
"Is it true that you once fought the Emperor?"
Arkadiana burst with laughter.
"Is that what Gaius says? I'm not quite that good. But like all good tales, there is some truth to it. My father, by birth, was battle king of the Turkic Nomad diaspora. He fought unification to the bitter end."
His smile grew strained. His memories of mortal childhood were dim, but filled with warmth and an affection he could no longer reproduce. Holding on to them was like holding a beautiful sword by the blade.
"I'm told he did indeed face the Emperor sword to sword in defense of the Bosphorus Canyon. I was his firstborn. Last heir to the Bosporic Turks,
a token of the nomad diaspora's compliance to the Emperor of all mankind. There were many like me then, tithed from collapsed or compliant dynasties to raise the third.
And how many of those continue to crusade?
He shrugged.
I'd consider it an honour to cross blades with you once more in the cages.
Arkadiwana sighed, reached up to take Santar's vapour-dampened pauldron in his hand, and smiled ruefully. Take a place in line, brother.
Before the Iron Hand's frown could develop further, the doors at the aft end of the footbridge irised open, and a procession of disparately robed and liveried figures filed through.
Santar pivoted his enormous armoured frame to look over his shoulder, granting Arkadiwana a view. Leading the procession with giant strides was Lord Commander Amadeus Duquesne. Like Arkadiwana, he had taken advantage of his respite to change and to bathe, and was clad now in a sleeveless vest and breeches of coarse black animal hair, covered by a fur-lined cloak trimmed with silver that hung to his knees. His muscular forearms were clapped in silver torques, bearing the icons of the Stormwalkers, symbols of the past and a clear allusion to a powerful present. Even without the archaic bulk of his thunder armour, the Lord Commander's presence was immense. His features were old Nordic, his body put together like the storm god of the Vikingir. His short hair was granite grey, towel dry and spiky. His face was a legacy of conquest, written in transhuman flesh, both record of honour and testament to the determination of the 10th Legion continually to return so battered a frame to the front line. Shrugging off the regimental staffers that harried his steps, like a warrior king pursued by attention-starved hounds, Duquesne crossed to Santar and Arkadiwana.
You put on your usual good show? They'll be talking about the day you put Santar on his arse for years.
Santar crossed his arms and said nothing. So that was why the legionary was so keen to face him again, to recover pride. Arkadiwana shook his head, another good reason to avoid entering a cage with the first captain. No need to rub salt in that wound.
Look alive,
Duquesne grunted, as the murmurs of the gathering officers abated and straightened his back to stand to attention. Set in the uncurved edge of the dais opposite the bridge was a door, a masterpiece of glittering diorite, white marble and iron. The vertical seam carried a relief of a hammer striking an anvil, impact fractures picked out in veins of silver. Elsewhere in the diorama were three-headed chimerae, ocean krakens and other legendary beasts of Medusa. It was the portal to the Iron Forge, the Primarch's most closely guarded reclusium, and in a hiss of steam and a wave of drying heat, the doors parted. Arkadiwana's skin tightened as it was dried, his heart's beating faster, as if he were a questing knight of old before the lair of a dragon. He swallowed hard. A week of exercises, feasts, and cultural indoctrination, and this would be his first time in the presence of Ferus Manus himself. Conversation ceased. Men dropped to their knees. Two veterans in the armour and markings of the Averni clan strode through the gate and took stations either side of the glowing portal. The dulled steel of their terminator plate steamed up at once, wreathed in the vapours that climbed from the decks below, but for the white fire of their helmet lenses. Past the sentinels marched two more warriors. The embossed nameplates on their high gorget rims identified them. Venerati Urien, Harrick Morn. Arkadiwana knew both warriors well. Neither one acknowledged him or any other as they emerged. They bore the Primarch's banners. To the left, a metaphor for the symbolic hand that was taken by so many of the Iron Hands, went the iron gauntlet of the Legion. The banner's device was stitched in silver on a field of black velvet. The edges were ripped and torn, as though attacked by dogs, re-sewn hundreds of times over to be made fit for the Emperor's war. Symbols within symbols. To the right went Ferus Manus's personal standard, an opus in velvet and an abundance of silver. It depicted his vanquishing of the silver worm, Azenoth. The Anvilarium had no table or chairs, no inbuilt precedence by which to arrange those present, and so low and high, mortal and giant transhuman mixed, like so many immiscible fluids forced into a crucible. The mortals were all men and women that Arkaduana had been shown pics of, or traded brief introductions with over the past days, all of them palpably uncomfortable to be rubbing shoulders with the giant legionaries of the 10th and 3rd. In addition to Gaius Caphon and Palaeolinus, Arkaduana recognised faces that belonged to names such as Varkal Desan, Ortek Moore, Ulrak Branthan, Shadrach Medjuson. He had yet to meet any of them personally. The arrival of the standard-bearers and their massive war gear forced them all back to the rim of the dais, and without further herald, the Primarch of the Iron Hands entered his Anvilarium. Arkaduana fell to his knees with a gasp. He had meant to take his cue from the Iron Hands around him, but the act of obeisance was instinctual, the only rational recourse to the presence of a demigod. The Primarch was to Fulgrim as iron to gold. He was a rugged, brutal giant, his height and breadth staggering even to one who had fought alongside such beings and seen them bleed as other men. His pale flesh was knotted and scarred, for his heart was that of a conqueror. He had brought to heel the most hostile of worlds known to the Imperium of Man, his own, and never once had he shirked from leading by example. His brow was furrowed and judgmental. His shale-coloured hair was cropped short. His armour was black, every surface hand-forged and perfect. Master Adept Malevolus, the same Master Adept Malevolus that had crafted Horus's famous warplate, had had a hand in its making, but the instinctual metallurgy of Ferus Manus himself was present in the acme of every accoutrement and curve. A high gorget of black iron rose at the back of the neck, silver edge-trims studded with rivets. The gauntlet emblem on his mantled shoulder-guard had been fashioned from a single piece of hand-beaten iron. Over the opposite shoulder there hung a cloak of thick mail rings, the immense warhammer forge-breaker hefted across it. The hand that gripped the ebon haft was molten, iridescent metal, emitting a siren chorus of brushed steel as it lapped about the Primarch's forearm with an apparent life of its own. His eyes captivated the chamber. They were like silver coins, unreflective, remote, and yet utterly enthralling. Arkaduana felt the awe he had earlier sought to conjure through his art rise in him unbidden. Ferus Manus was not renowned for his beauty. He did not haunt the dreams of men in the way of Fulgrim or Sanguinius or Horus. But he was beautiful, as a charbonal sabre or a hand-wrought suit of armour could be beautiful. Arkaduana saw now why Fulgrim loved this Gorgon so, and why that love was reciprocated so fiercely. He was perfect. Perfect in every way.
"My sons," said Ferus, his voice like beaten lead, his demand for absolute perfection in all things like a hand pressing bowed heads towards the ground. "You shame me."
The Iron Hands adored their brutal father, but biddable they were not. They responded to their Primarch's accusation with predictable outcry. It could not last. Their collar was, to his, as a candle flame to a vacuum.
"I did not propose this exercise with my brother, in the expectation of seeing my warriors bested."
Santar made as if to speak out, but a look from his Primarch silenced him.
"It was to demonstrate my legion's prowess, and by reflection, my prowess."
The effort of marshalling his frustrations was clearly immense. Arkaduana doubted he made the effort for his own legionary's benefit.
"It seems that the 3rd Legion has much to teach us."
"We'll adapt. Do better next time,"
Duquesne spoke out.
"That was the point, wasn't it?"
Ferrus Manus smouldered for what felt like half a minute.
There will be no next time. While you were engaged on Vesta, word was received from the Ultramarines of the 413th Expedition. Our brothers call for aid.
A warship of the Third Legion would have rejoiced at news of another Legion's crusades. Space was vast, dispatches rare, and so even word of their brothers' travails came as a rare gift in what could be a lonely war. The same, he was sure, would ordinarily have been true for the Fist of Iron, though he suspected that news of another's glories would be less a cause for celebration than a goad towards greater triumphs of their own. But pride had been stung, and the Iron Hands brooded as Ferrus went on.
The 413th is a minor expeditionary force. 5 regiments of the Imperial Army, 2,000 legionary warriors, predominantly 13th Legion. They were tasked with the compliance of a solar empire ruled by a technologically equivalent human offshoot called the Gardinal. Emissaries of my brother Magnus's legion were dispatched to negotiate a peaceable transition to imperial rule. Their industrial capacity and military strength were apparently deemed sufficient to justify concessions.
His mouth twisted with disdain.
A miscalculation. Strength respects only strength. The Ultramarines stepped in when negotiations failed. At present, that is all we know.
We can't answer every plea for help, said Santar. The 12th Expedition is not much further from Gardinal than we are. Let Lord Gilliman bear the burden of his own failure.
You cannot be serious,
Arcduana cried, shouting down the muttered chorus of agreement. He stepped into the empty space that had grown around the Primarch and his vexillaries.
Warriors of the Legiones Astartes perish on worlds that are the rightful inheritance of mankind. A blow struck against one is a blow struck against all, and against the Emperor himself, beloved by all. Are we to let that stand? We who stand together now, and dare to call one another brother?
A shimmer of approval spirited across the liquid silver of Ferris's eyes, but the Primarch made no further contribution.
Extensive ground and fleet deployments have been made to numerous joint exercises around Vesta and her near-space environs,
said Adept Xanthus, Mechanican representative to the 52nd Expedition.
Aye, said Leyric.
The Fist of Iron's shipmaster was a bull of a man, thick neck, full beard, broad chest, all constrained within a stiff military black staff coat, bursting with medals. His bald head shone.
It'll take time to claw it all back.
The feudal structures of the Iron Hands were difficult for an outsider to understand. In place of the companies and chapters of the Principia Bellicosa were independent and often competing clans. Each clan was self-sufficient, distinct in character and strength, but functioned like an interlocking cog in the great war machine of Ferrus Manus's construction. The Legion as a whole was a leviathan. Once in motion, it was unstoppable, but its semi-autonomous structures and its many independent hierarchies made it difficult to organize on such a scale. The 52nd Expedition fleet boasted about 2/3 of the Legion's strength, 70,000 legionaries, 6 million army and Scitari auxilia, and a pool of war machines the envy even of Gilliman and Lorgar, and the very largest of the Space Marine legions. It took some turning.
The Crusade is changing, said Ferrus distantly. The days when I could count my rivals on one hand are gone forever.
He studied his metal hand, it and his eyes setting up a mutually non-reflective play of convection patterns and colour.
There are those amongst my brothers who doubt me.
My Lord Primarch.
Arcduana stepped forward, denial bursting from his breast. Ferrus Manus shook his head.
There are those who doubt. The Crusade is changing, but all must be proven anew. I will save the 413th. I will show Rabute what my legion is capable of as I drag his warriors from the precipice.
The second company will go wherever you bid, my lord,
said Arkituana.
We are yours until Fulgrim returns to command otherwise.
Watching Ferris smile, it was like watching steel cool into the shape of a blade.
Indeed. We will see how much there is to be learned from one another when our weapons are live and our brothers stand or fall by our strength.
Arkaduana smiled to see 3rd and 10th Legion officers subtly re-evaluating one another's measure. Call it strength that these beings aspired to. Call it perfection. Call it competition.
You have proven your competence, Ferris said to him, and my brother speaks of you highly.
Fulgrim was more fulsome in his praises than his brother, but Arkaduana held his counsel. He had the feeling that this had less to do with honouring him than it did with censuring others, and perhaps it was partly about sending a message to his brother Primarchs that he could lead, with an even temper and an even hand. The crusade was changing, or so went the rumour.
I would have you assume the role of my equerry, for as long as the compliance of Gardenal requires.
Arkaduana heard Santar's sharp intake of breath, but the Primarch had not, he noted, given him an option to refuse. Unsure what else to do under such circumstances, Arkaduana acceded to the unwanted honour with a bow.
It is my privilege to serve the Gorgon.
There were two fighters in the cage. The warrior of the Emperor's children, Moses, did not know, though given his current assignment, he realised that he probably should. The warrior was an Adonis of hard muscle and calligraphic tattoos, his cream toga hanging over his cincture to give him a double-layered skirt and a bare chest. His hair was copper gold, tied in a warrior braid, wound several times around his neck. For a warrior of his apparent age, his physique was pristine. There was not a scar or a bionic graft on him. It was as though he had been sculpted from mother of pearl. The Iron Hands legionary that opposed him could not have been more different. The Averni clan veteran was a siege tank, a hulking agglomeration of rods, plates, and stupendously enlarged musculature that glistened with oils. His face, ablatively reconstructed and slab-featured, was alight with anticipation. Venerati Urien, everyone knew. Amongst the Vergan clan, he had been a legend. A Terran, but the fiercest proponent of the clan's ancient credo of efficiency and power. There were plenty among the clan fathers who still resented the Averni clan for poaching their most celebrated captain. Moses had fought in several skirmishes and won pitched battle over the slight, but held no personal rancour towards Urien. A position with the Averni clan's First Order was what any warrior of Urien's status and ambition aspired to. Moses would have done the same.
"Are we wagering?"
said Moses. Vertinus laughed. "You're one of us now, brother. We wouldn't do that to you."
"Not so fast," said Paleolinus. "We may have just discovered an actual vice in our new brother. This needs to be nurtured and encouraged."
The wing commander's face was alabaster pale and without flaw, but for a tiny shrapnel scar that cleft the top of his cheek like a teardrop. His face was expressive, quick to smile, but there was steel there that only a fool could miss. His eyes, when they set upon a thing, were as piercing and as cold as diamond.
"If Urien triumphs, then you can sit in that cockpit until Kama returns with us to the pride of the Emperor. I promise no one will bother you. And if yours wins?"
Something about that raised chuckles all around.
"Don't you even recognise Captain Arkaduana?"
Vertinus asked.
"It's not entirely surprising," Edoran sniffed. "He's a very arm's-length commander."
Moses frowned and looked again. The cage was one of the smaller examples of the sparring rings that filled the practice hall. Barely big enough for two, it was built for grapples and throws, trials of balance and upper body strength, at which the Iron Hands traditionally excelled, and for which Venerati Urien could have been custom-made. He was aware of Arkaduana's reputation, but this contest was skewed against him.
Agreed. It's your coin,
Edoran snorted, turning to watch the fight. Lord Commander Duquesne pushed through the crowd of eager spectators to thump his fists against the bars and bellowed,
Fight!
Urien and Arkaduana were already close enough to taste the oils on the other's flesh. At the Lord Commander's shout, Urien exploded forward like an armor-plated grox given an electric shock, intending to wrestle his opponent to the ground. Arkaduana should have been flattened. Simple as that. No matter how Moses tweaked his understanding of spatial geometry and bodily mechanics, he could not understand how he was not. Urien's face crashed into the bars. Arkaduana was behind him, driving him to his knees with one of his own buried in a little-known pressure point under the oolitic kidney. Urien struggled for a moment, red-faced, but the effort clearly caused him pain. He winced, then finally grunted in surrender. Duquesne was still getting his breath back. It had taken about half a second.
What just happened?
Moses muttered, as Duquesne began to thump his hands together and encourage the stunned legionaries to cheer. Vertinus had the good grace to look guilty about allowing a brother to take the wager, even as he clapped along approvingly.
Victories to come, brother,